Hello, everyone. I'm Kevin Weiner. Thanks for tuning in to another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. And as always, I have a question for you. Is there an area of personal change that you have found extremely difficult? Well, you're not alone. In today's podcast and post, I will add another layer of instruction to our last post on embodiment with an examination of how both sin and renewal work within us. Now, join me now as I prove that all of our problems are first truth problems and how that cascades into personal sin and evil in the world. You can also learn how our architecture is not broken, but designed in wisdom to allow the entire cosmos to be healed, starting with ourselves. Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for coming back to yet another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. I am your host. My name is Kevin Winder, and I like to serve the world as an online pastor, author, and coach, among many other things I do in the world. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you are new, I want to welcome you to this program. Welcome to this community. Welcome to a very interesting group of people who gather around very unique and interesting content. No, this is not entertainment. This is true life instruction. It's hacks. It is tools. It's resources that will restore your life, your family, and the world. And so today we continue, and we are going to look a little bit deeper at some of the architecture of how we do what we do. You know, we've all had that experience where we want to change something and find that change to be much harder than we anticipated. Maybe you have something you want to stop doing and you realize, oh, I can't stop for some reason. This is going to help all of that. And so we're going to jump right in. This is podcast number 464, and I call it The Architecture of Sin and Renewal. Okay. So let's first talk about the feedback and some of the conversations I've had from my post entitled Ultimate Cheesecake. You know, this is where I realized that far too many people haven't read my book, or you're new to the program. You just don't understand these frameworks. And so there was a lot of confusion. You see, the subject of embodiment and contemplation is confusing to a lot of people, first of all, because religion doesn't generally teach you this. And second, what I was saying is a nuance that most pastors are going to steer very far and clear from. And so if you interpreted my last podcast on the ultimate cheesecake as a license to sin, where I basically say, how bad can I be and still go to heaven? If you interpreted me as giving you that, then you really missed it. That's because religion has probably trapped you into some kind of a small wineskin where you conflate the behaviors with sins. And that's exactly how our world sees things. A sin is a thing you do, right? It's the bad thing you do. It's your naughtiness. Now, and when that happens, we go about life trying to not do some things, right? I mean, if you're trying to live a more pure moral life, you're going to say, I'm going to stop doing that thing, which is a bad thing. And that's great. That's a great place to start. I think we all have these aspects in our life where we know we're doing something that's destroying us, causing us to be sick, unhealthy, unwise, erode relationships, go into debt, kill our environment. I mean, there's a million things, right? And so when you go and you decide you're going to not do some things, you realize it's really hard. And you try and not do those things, except for when those sins are behaviors that you actually want to do. Or they seem like they're going to provide you an advantage at the time. I don't want to lie, but if I tell the truth, I'm going to screw myself in my job. So I'm going to tell this lie so that I can get the advancement, right? Whatever it might be. Sometimes we question if our behaviors are even sinful at all. In fact, our world likes to go around and redefine things that used to be called sins or problems or dysfunctions as normal, not wrong, acceptable, right? Just changing the definition helps people feel like they don't have to change. And then we do them anyway. And then we return. If we're religious people, we return to our rituals. Oh, we better read some Bible. You better have a prayer time. You better go to church. You better have the priest do something. You better confess. You better have a communion. You better sing some songs. You better do something to cleanse yourself. Make yourself feel better about doing the thing you said you weren't going to do. Right? At least until next time. And this is how we get into what I've always called shampoo Christianity, where you just sin, wash, repeat, sin, wash, and repeat. And really what's behind all of that is not just the difficulty of personal change. It's actually something much bigger, okay? And we're going to talk about that today. And I didn't want to break this into two posts, so you're going to have to give yourself the time to hear it. But I do think the content is going to be interesting to you. And the way that I lay it out is going to kind of pull you in. So this post, which is pushing 2,000 words, is probably going to, you know, be at that 45 minutes to an hour session. But I want you to give yourself to understand this, right? I want you to really figure this out, because I'm going to explain this unseen process that's working within the architecture of our humanity and how nothing is actually broken. And how the world's futile remedies don't work, and why they don't work, and why you don't need a drug therapy most likely, and why you don't need a 10-year counseling endeavor to sit on a couch and pour out your heart and ask a bunch of invasive questions. I'm not advocating for, you know, some kind of a quick fix that's going to be, oh, you come to this service, you say this prayer, and you're healed forever. You never go back to it. That is never happens. And when it does, it's an anomaly. Most of us are in the process of gradual transformation. And I am advocating for an embodied spirituality, right? You are a body and a spirit. Right? You don't have a spiritual life. You are a spiritual life in a body. And so this experience goes both ways. Sometimes you go deeper into the spiritual experience, and sometimes you come into the bodily experience. And I'm showing you how these two aspects are not two sides of a coin. They are part of a waveform, which means there's highs and lows, closes and fars, and all those other pieces, okay? And I want you to have an embodied spirituality of faith and Christ following. And that may not make sense to you. That might even offend you. You might not want that. But stick here, because you're going to learn something about how you've been designed. And all of this comes out of the Bible. This is biblical revelation, what I'm revealing to you today. So if this is the first time you've heard it, put on your floaties, because we're going to the deep end. And just before we get started, let me just make a note here that the Bible tells us that we are image bearers, that we are made in the image of God, right? It also says that we are sinners. Okay? These are two aspects of our nature. Right. And so these two aspects of our nature, we have to really figure out how they work within us. And to learn more about why I use the language that I'm going to use of shadow and image, I have a post where I talk a lot about that. I invite you to go check it out. It's linked in my post. Okay. So let's start with a case study, and then we're going to go into the architecture of how all this works, okay? So for this case study, I want you to think about a person. Now, this person knows they have a problem in this particular area, but they find themselves going back to this sinful behavior again and again. Now, the problem compounds often when they are online. In other words, when they're alone or they're on their computer, they find themselves getting sucked in to this problem. It's not every time, but a lot of the times it happens, it's when they're online. And there are certain websites that trigger this cascade of thoughts and affections and behaviors. So this person tries to avoid these sites, these websites, when they're on the computer, but eventually they go back to them. They just have too much of a gravitational pull, and once they click on them, the dopamine triggers begin to flow in their brain. And they begin what I call death scrolling through image after image until they find the one that hits. They click, they dive deeper. There's more images. There's even a video for them to consume. And their infections grow and their wanter inflames within them until they ignore their best judgment and overrule their own safeguards. Pretty soon, they're doing that thing they swore they wouldn't do again. And they reject the wisdom that they've possessed, and they take action which leads them to the satisfaction of that thing which they said they wouldn't do. Okay? That's our case study. Maybe you find yourself written into that scenario. Now, why I set it up in a very clever way, hoping to open something up in you. I tried to kind of frame it so that you might think this is a person looking at pornography or something on the computer. We might assume this is an example of someone looking at nude people, right? Of course, nude people are not pornography, and that's a whole other subject. So if you have questions about that, write me, let me know. But it could just as easily have been someone doing online shopping, or examining recipes for their next indulgence, or a traveler picking another destination. And most of those don't seem like they're on par with pornography, right? Each of these behaviors in and of themselves is not sinful. And of course, like I said, don't get confused with looking at nude people with pornography. But I set it up that way so that you could hopefully see something. You know, a porn channel and the Food Network are not different. So here's what happens. Each of these behaviors in and themselves are not the sin. But depending upon the affections in the heart and the context of each individual, this could be equally sinful and destructive. So, like last week, I said some people can have 3 pieces of cheesecake while some people can't have any. And it's, you need to know yourself well enough to know the difference. You can't just, like religion, make a big rule, no cheesecake. Right? That's the nuance. I'm helping you find your freedom. But if you can't see these as potentially equal sins of the shadow self, then you don't yet have the biblical understanding of sin. And that's certainly to be expected because most people don't have a biblical understanding of sin, especially religious people who are in these cultures of religion and church and moral purity. They don't understand sin like they say they do. The subject matter of the internet, right? Whatever is coming through the computer is not what is sinful. It is the heart of the consumer. This is what makes Jesus' teaching so powerful. I shared this with you last week, Mark 7:15. It was the thesis of my PhD doctorate. There is nothing outside of a person that by going into him can defile him or her. Okay? It's not the recipe site. It's not the Food Network. It's not naked images that defile you. Can you receive that? Or is that biblical truth outside your range? And if it is, I want to help you here. And this is why I elected to give you this instruction today. This is a course on how you're made, how God has designed you. Okay, now there are inner workings that happen, and this is the process. Sin is not necessarily a behavior, but certainly can be a behavior. And using our case study, there are contexts when nudity is clinical. It's celebrated. It's to be enjoyed as God designed it. Online shopping is convenient and sometimes necessary. Recipes are fun, creative, and bring joy to gatherings. Religion has told us what behaviors are acceptable, and thus our judging, Platonic, dualistic shadow mind judges behaviors as good or bad, naughty or nice, and we define others by those behaviors. That's what's wrong with religion. The Bible and its teaching is far more nuanced than that. And in order to understand it, we must not focus on the behavior, but on the internal workings which lead to behaviors, okay? So, if you were to follow the headwaters all the way up to where they start, everything starts at ground zero, and that is your understanding of the truth, okay? All genuine sin is a truth problem, not a behavior problem. It's a problem of either apprehension, meaning we don't know something is a sin, we don't know the truth, or application. We know the truth, but we ignore it, right? So everything is a sin, every behavior that you want to change is a truth problem of either apprehension or application. And these are the conscious rebellion or the unconscious deception of the too far that I spoke about in my cheesecake post, right? You go too far, and you either do it consciously or unconsciously. If you do it consciously, it's rebellion. If you do it unconsciously, it's deception. So are you a rebel or are you deceived? Well, and most of us are both. And see, we all presuppose the truth. We all think we have it. We derive our worldview from it. We go around with a way of seeing the world, making assumptions about how the world works. This is the function of truth within us. And we all assume we have the truth, and therefore we don't continually seek the truth. It's not usually until we're in pain or we're suffering, we have a problem. We realize we don't have the truth. We've got something wrong, and that thing that's wrong is causing the problem. See, we don't continually seek truth, nor are we trained what to do with the truth once we discover it. In fact, we're so convinced we have the truth that when we hear new truth that's wider and bigger in scope and dimension than what we possess, we almost always assume that wider truth is not true at all. So we're not even trained on what to do when we encounter new truth, wider truth, bigger truth. Most people locate the seat of truth within our affections. And you can tell this by people going around determining if something is true based upon whether we are favorable to it. This is the quagmire of politics. Oh, I like that, so it must be true. Folks, that is such a false way to live, and I'm going to explain this later, but the seed of truth is not in our affections, it's in the intellect, it's in the mind, it's our conscious understanding of how all things integrate. Now, this is maybe complex for you, maybe a little bit esoteric, because you haven't been trained or you haven't thought about this, but truth is not siloed. It's not like you have this truth and then that truth, the truth about drywall, the truth about car engines, the truth about sin, the truth about faith, the truth about love are not all separate silos of truth. There's only one, and they all integrate. Your understanding of love is exactly how engines work. And if you can't connect those two, that's because you are living in a lesser amount of truth that is disintegrated. The pieces of life are disintegrated. As you grow in truth, in the intellect, all the pieces integrate. They converge. Truth is not siloed. It converges everything. And then people with less truth have more disintegrated lives. And sin germinates when we conclude something is true when it's actually not true or only partially true. Like if I conclude that air will hold me up when I walk off that cliff, I will appraise the cliff very differently than the person who holds to the belief that air cannot hold you up and you will fall to your death. Right? You can, if you think air holds you up, if you conclude something is true when it's not true, the result is disintegration. It's sin. It's the breakdown and the ruin of your life. This is the architecture of how everything's made. And it's very consistent. It's immovable. It does not change. So in our case study, sin is conceived, as James 1:15 would say, when the person's desire for something becomes an over-desire, an epithumia for something. Oh, I just want to sit down and see if the price of those lawn chairs came down. Really? Okay. Now, if you really need lawn chairs and it's an important decision that you've made and you have the budget and the means within to do so, then great, go shopping. If you're just using it as a gateway to get on the computer and scroll through that website that always sucks you in and causes you to spend money against the will of your loved one and against the wisdom of your budget, then that is not a looking at the lawn chair. See, we know this has happened when that thing is believed to be more satisfying than fidelity to the truth about a budget, right? The truth about human connection and intimacy, right? Oh, you know, this naked person, this, you know, watching these people do these things is going to satisfy me more than something else, right? It's like you don't understand true human connection. And so this is the surrogate you're settling for. Oh, this recipe, this one, oh, I've got to make this. This looks so good, right? You're just inflamed with your wanter wants it so bad. And so you think of an excuse to bring it to a party or whatever else, but you really just want to make it for yourself. And it goes against what you know is true about health and your personal decisions. This is called deception. It's the loss of truth, right? This is why ground zero is truth, okay? The next ladder, the next rung on the ladder as we move outward towards behavior is our intellect, right? And I said that truth is seated in the intellect, into our mind, our consciousness. It's the warehouse of wisdom, our skill, and our will to use the knowledge we possess. If you get a lot of knowledge, you don't gain wisdom. Wisdom is skill. So you could have a child with very little knowledge but tremendous wisdom. They can use what they know very well. And you could have somebody with a lot of knowledge and no wisdom, like some big professor who has all this accumulated knowledge but no ability to use it with skill. So information and knowledge are helpful, but not if we don't employ them with the skill or wisdom. And therefore, deception is behind every sin of our shadow self. Since we can't comprehend or will not apply the truth we possess, all deception is a self that doesn't know its true self, namely, to know itself as the beloved of God. That's why I started out with that part. You see, instead of deceived, a deceived intellect believes itself to be something or someone else. We all go around with these little masks on our face, upokrito. We all go around trying to present, to front, to be someone or something that we may not be, or fake it until we make it, or put on a good show, or whatever it is, right? This is that fake ID, that pseudonym. This is what I mean. This is a deceived person who believes themselves to be something or someone that they aren't. Like when you believe your own delusion, you know the results of your life are not going to be good fruit. And from this ontological, meaning this center of being, this identity, this who you are, your true self, this deception of the self, we construct our grasp of reality, conferring with others who also suffer from self-deception. So we create these echo chambers of people who don't know who they are. And by not knowing or believing who we truly are, we find satisfaction or distraction in things of the world rather than finding satisfaction in God. And Kierkegaard just nails this in his book, A Sickness Unto Death, when he defines sin as the refusal to be oneself before God. And Paul similarly defines sin as this opposite of faith. Sin is non-faith when he says, whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. Okay, so in our case study, the sin occurs in the intellect when this person concluded that they are someone other than who they truly are. And how do you know that? Well, this always shows up as self-pity. This is the easiest telltale mark that your intellect is sliding off the slope, meaning that you've concluded you are somebody that you aren't, because you start making excuses for yourself. Well, I need this. I've been wanting this for a long time. I've been looking for this. My spouse doesn't blah, 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 and therefore I'm entitled to this. I just really need this, or I just, you know, that self-pity, those streams of consciousness are coming straight from a delusion, a self-delusion. And you're going to justify in the moment that you do not need to be yourself, the beloved, before God. This is also where a person concludes they're not before God. They forget that God is breathing breath into them with every breath. The gaze of God's eye is staring right into them every moment. God never looks away. And some people are absolutely annoyed with that idea. That idea has, I can see why when you want to do wrong, why you want to not have the stare or gaze of God upon you, the presence of God intimately so close you can't even reach out. By the time you've reached out, you've touched God. But as you grow in faith, you realize that proximity is your salvation. Okay? So that's the intellect. So you have a disordered truth. It forms a worldview. It makes you think you are something that you're not, right? And then the affections, the next ladder. Wrong on the ladder is the affections. And most people live within their affections. Like, we live in a world that is captive to their wanters. We desire one thing, then we desire the next thing once we get it. And we go on to the next thing and the next thing. And it's a chain of unconscious creaturely existence. A person who exists completely from their affections is constantly in a state of self-delusion. They react to every stimuli of the environment, and they don't react very well. They're usually overreacting. They're never in a place of homeostasis or calm. They adapt to trying to feel good. Others can't get out of feeling bad. And so they live in this constant tension of how they feel. They're so in their feelings, their affections. And this is true confusion. And becoming free from that trap requires profound change in worldview. It's going to require that you overwrite what you think is true with what is actually true. It will require a truth. You have a truth problem, not an emotional problem. You don't have a quick temper. You're not emotionally reactive. It's not that you struggle with forgiveness or getting over stuff. You have a truth problem. See, every addiction is a self who has mistakenly concluded that their desire or appetite is a good gauge of reality. It's not. Truth that is external and objective can and does override the affections. But a person in self-delusion believes truth is internal and subjective. Do you see that difference? So in our case study, our person has rejected objective truth. And they scroll to satisfy the appetite for the next dopamine rush. They're slaves to their neurotransmitters, not realizing that objective truth can rewire that dependence. Once our affections define reality, life becomes chaotic. It's unsettled. These are people that are never on a flat plane of chill. These are people that are up, down, all around. You never know who you're getting. This is what it means to be, as James put it in 1:15, to be pregnant with sin. Okay? So you've got the truth, you've got the intellect, you've got the affections, and the next rung on the ladder is our will. And people give way too much power and credit to willpower. In fact, that doesn't actually exist. The will doesn't actually have power of its own. The purpose of the will is not to have power. The function of the will is to transduce non-physical reality into physical reality. It's a transducer. All the stuff that's going on in your subterranean brain, in your emotion, in your thought, in your captivity to truth, is now going to turn into something in the world. Your idea of the taco becomes the taco, right? That's what the will does. The affections of our wanter enlist the will continually to take action. It doesn't matter what action, it's going to find the first and fastest action that will satisfy the affections. It will do nothing more and it will do nothing less. And once those affections are satisfied, the will rests until the affections are inflamed again with over-desire, what the Bible calls epithumia. See, the will is just continually activated to seek out a means of satisfaction. And this is the process that just starts over and over. And when a person says they can't stop, what they mean is my affections are contrary to stopping. You have to hear this, okay? And let me prove this to you. So when a person says, well, I just can't, you know, put the chips down or whatever, right? Okay, well, let's just assume that in our case study, this person has a loved one who would be really disappointed if they came in and found them doing it again, whatever that thing is, online, right? So now this person is online, they're all by themselves, right? And then they hear the garage door open or they hear the loved one coming upstairs or coming into their proximity. And then they quickly close out that web page, delete the browser history, and go on as if they weren't doing that thing, right? Because while they claim they can't stop, it's actually a lie, because they can stop as soon as the affections for not being caught are stronger than the affection to death scroll. Do you see how that works? Yeah. And so this is how it always works. This is the way that we're designed. But most of us are absolutely clueless to this. And I am surprised, in the world of psychology, none of this is very well known. And half the stuff out there doesn't understand this architecture, perhaps because it's biblically derived and most people don't read their Bible. Okay? But the last rung on the ladder is the action. Right? This is where our actions are the behaviors where our loss of truth and self end up in the world. Actions are externally measured behaviors which we judge as good or bad. Oh, I did that thing again. And you think that the thing was the sin, not realizing that the whole time you were in sin. You were pregnant with it. It's like a woman who gives birth and goes, man, I just gave birth to a baby, not realizing for 9 months she was pregnant. See, religion and all the law lives here. They live in the actions. They live and predicate on the behaviors. Our world is a meritocracy of behaviors, and that's not all bad. We can measure behaviors. We can measure production, output, efficiency, effectiveness, whether you got it done or didn't get it done. And all of that speaks to everything that's inside, but you can only really measure accurately the behavior. So that's where the world lives. That's the letter of the law. It's very punitive. It lacks nuance. You could put a person in jail for statutory rape if the person that they were with was one day before their 18th birthday. And one day after their 18th birthday, they did not commit a crime. That's the law. You know, the letter of the law is exacting. It's punitive, right? And it doesn't wiggle. And that's how behaviors are measured. And this is why the biblical revelation has done away with the law and its moral requirements. It's the end of religion. Read Colossians 2:20. And this is why I'm taking the time to explain this to you and explain an embodied spirituality where you have freedom in Christ to know your limit. And you can go to the limit and then stop because you are governed by the heart, by your walk and your faith. And if you gain strength, that could change. So the rule that applies when you're 12 may not apply when you're 16 or 30 or 50. Like, this is an amazing way and path to freedom, and everybody is governed by God upon the heart and not upon the institution, which robs you. See, and this is amazing. Instead of religion and law, which exacts our actions in a punitive form, it's replaced with a faith in knowing who we are in God as we follow Christ in his human example, which is his physical life. He had a physical life governed by the Spirit of God in truth, and we are to follow in his footsteps. He said, "Follow me. Try this thing too. I will give you the Spirit that I have, so that you can do even greater things than I have done." This is the model. We follow Christ in our humanity, in our bodies, in our spirituality together. The action was the thing that promised us satisfaction. That's always the action. And when we do it, this is known as idolatry. Can you see why now? Can you see why, like, instead of trusting God, we said, "This other thing will give me more joy"? That's idolatry. All right, so now that you understand the mechanics of how it all works, now we can see our need for truth to be graciously revealed to us in God's word. See, only God, our maker, gets to say who we are. Now, the world likes to spend time and dollars and calories trying to focus on behavior modification strategies. They come up with new drugs, new neurotransmitter drugs that will, you know, keep your happy dopamine around longer. They'll keep the serotonin floating around in your brain longer. But all that does is rewire your brain to adapt to more amounts of the serotonin in the drugs, and then it makes it really dangerous for you to stop that therapy quickly. So if you're on one, don't get it with a doctor if you want to make a change. But they come up with other therapies, like you have to do these things and go talk about your family of origin and do this kind of communication style, blah, 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 to get our emotions and our will in line and to try and convince us that we can do it. And we try behavior modification and immersion. And this is what psychology is all about. It thinks it owns the subterranean environment of the human life, and it doesn't. Only God gets to say who we are. Only God has designed how we work. And inevitably, everything that's outside of that will fail you, just as it does me. And since our world is convinced that we are what we do, its cure is to either redefine wrongdoing as not wrong or to force a change from the outside in. So all it can do is bludgeon you with a rule, punish you for breaking it, or just say, well, there's nothing wrong with that. You shouldn't even bother trying to change. Now, hopefully now you can see how foolish this is and why it never really works. This is why you feel the way you do inside. This is called tension. This is what I call a low-grade fever. It's just this constant grind. It's death by paper cuts. You can never get to that place where you feel peace. You can't feel joy. You can't live smoothly and clearly because you can't see. You don't know. You're deceived. You are pregnant with sin, as we all are. Okay? How do we get around that? Well, God's cure is inside out, not outside in. This is Paul's teaching in the New Testament, is we are replacing religion, which is outside in, with inner transformation, which is inside out. By learning who we truly are, we are hidden in Christ, hidden in our embodied humanity, and found in God. We are the beloved. You are the beloved. What you do does not change that. Our doing does not create our being. Our being creates our doing. You are the beloved. Now, if you believe that, it starts the cascade effect, that all of those ladders work on different software. But when you don't believe that, when you feel like, oh, I'm a loser. God hates me. I'm rejected. There is no God. There's this dead. We're just random. Like, there is no amount of truth that can overwrite that. You will always feel that deep sense of angst and existential pain. You can't free yourself until you get the software correct. You, yes, you are the beloved. And guess what? You are also a sinner, just like me. We are all prone to sin. This is how we are designed. It wasn't until after Adam and Eve sinned that God said, "Behold, now they have become like one of us." Creation of humanity was not done until after the fall. Let that one sink in there. Now, said another way, we are physical, prone to not see the spiritual world very well. This is very common. Our empirical scientific world doesn't even believe the spiritual world exists, even though it's illogical to say so because they believe mathematics exists and there's no empirical evidence that that should exist either. So this is why everything starts out so blurry. This is why we all walk in confusion, blind, as the Bible calls us, bumping into one another. Paul calls us that we are a nation of feelers and crawlers. We're trying to find our way in the world. But it becomes clearer as we allow this truth that we are the beloved to reconstruct our worldview. And so a lot of our worldview has to be deconstructed, has to be disassembled so that the right bricks can be put in the right place. And this is what I do in my uncoaching. It's disassembly so that we can reassemble. The ontological center informs this new intellect, which uses the same architecture of our bodies to embody not our shade and our shadow, but the image of God. Oh, so now the image is going to come forth through the same architecture. This truth of who we are emerges increasingly over time in how we live and produces so much fruit for our renewal. This makes our wanter want to gain a hunger and thirst for more of God's word and God's truth and God's instruction. This is why we're spending the next couple years in Psalm 119. Because every line of it is about God's word. Line by line, Isaiah said, precept upon precept. This changes our affections. And our will activates a set of new behaviors. If your affection is for God's voice, God's commands, God's precepts, God's direction, God's help, then guess what? You have new behaviors that shape on the back end of that affection, because the will will only enact that behavior which seeks satisfaction for the affection. You're not even trying. It's just happening. It never fails because you are not broken. See, if your shadow self is winning, if you can't seem to break free that addiction or that thing, that compulsion, just know that everything is working perfectly. And that is actually your hope, just like it is mine. Romans tells us, Paul says, God has consigned all of us to disobedience so that he may have mercy on us all. Folks, we all start out pregnant with sin, constantly putting new eggs and zygotes into the system over and over and over and over, giving birth after birth after birth to sinful behaviors which bring evil and pain and suffering into the world. But he's also done so that he may have mercy on us all. And we need only ask for his help. James says, if anybody lacks wisdom, let him ask God. And if you do, God is not going to drop you. He's going to graciously provide you with exactly what we need for this next moment. Nothing more. Okay, guys, hear this. You're not going to get some miracle lifelong fix. Lord, I have a problem with pornography. Forgive me. Oh, what? Oh, thank you, Jesus. And now I never, ever, ever, ever have those desires again. Like, that's BS. Everything you desire in sin remains the desire. The goal is to not make it an over desire, right? And as God comes in, he doesn't do a lifelong hack in almost no cases. What he gives you is exactly what you need for this moment. He gives you enough sight to see for right now. Like driving at night, you only see the next 100 feet. It's manna just for today. You don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow has enough problems of its own. Worry about right now. Stay here. Be present. Stay in the presence. This is where your spirit can override your flesh. As soon as you wander off into the past, wander off into wondering about the future, worrying about this thing or that thing, you've lost any power to change or heal. See, his light within us casts a necessary shadow. And that shadow will hijack our seeing the moment we lose consciousness of who we are before God. It's so delicate. It's so subtle. No amount of spirituality or praying can get you out of this. It's a necessary tension that honors God and builds you up. And this is why contemplative prayer is the utmost importance. Silly Sunday school prayers asking God to take away our desires for being bad will always bounce off the ceiling. But silence and stillness before our Maker, breathing in God, breathing out our humanity back to God, yields a humanity within our struggle, not despite our struggle. And that pleases God. If God wanted to get rid and eradicate sin from your life, he would just do it. But he's far more glorified by your struggle with sin than he is by the removal of it. And that's why he graces us with enough love. He graces us with enough desire to seek another moment of divine union. As these moments kind of string together, a renewed mind, a renewed life emerges. And from that, a renewed family, a renewed community, and a renewed world. This is not a one-and-done fix, folks. Give yourself and others grace and time to learn who we are and how we work. And once we do, love of others becomes easy, and that's how we know we're on the right track. Paul said it this way, and with this quote I will close: "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." God bless you as you contemplate these things.